You are entering the Royals Podcast Network.
A show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
Belted to left field. Billy comes through tonight. Splash!
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
And welcome in to another week of the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. I, of course, am your host, Jeff Herr, and with me, as always, is Michael Engel. Michael, how are you doing this evening?
I'm pretty good tonight. Can't complain about too much. I think that's what I usually say.
You know, I think that's how it usually goes, but you are not one to complain, sir, and that's what everybody loves about you, I'm sure. So
it's got to be something, because they keep talking to you.
We got a lot to cover today. One really kind of in-depth topic we talked about last week with Royals and home runs and how big of a difference is Kauffman Stadium. We didn't have the, it was just something that we kind of came to in our discussion. We didn't really have the numbers. So Michael spent tons of time this week researching and looking up all the numbers, and we're going to bring those to you, and we're going to discuss that in the second segment. But first we got some Royal stuff to catch you up on. By that, I mean just the Royals continuing to kind of middle their way through the season. At this point now, they are 12-11, and they just finished up a road trip against the Indians and the Orioles, two teams that are about at the Royals level. So if you want to gauge competitiveness for where the Royals should be, you know, teams like the Twins, they should be beating them pretty easily. But teams like the Indians, Orioles, they're a little bit more evenly matched. And that's about what we saw. They went 3-4 on the road trip. They had some close games. They had looked like in the Orioles series, their bats kind of came alive a little bit, especially yesterday. We're doing this on Monday. What's August 27th? Is that what today is?
28th.
Sorry. So the 27th.
Well, I made the same mistake myself. So
there you go. The game the Royals played on the 27th. That's what I was thinking of. It wasn't actually a mistake. That's what I was thinking of. But the game the Royals actually played on the 27th against the Orioles, they went 8-2. Omar Infante just had a monster game. 6 RBIs, 2 of 3 with a walk. He's got 17 RBIs, I believe, now on the season, which is just, mm-hmm. I heard this on the radio this morning. I want to say it was on the Border Patrol. He had 6 RBIs yesterday. That is one less than Eric Hosmer has on the whole season. And then as many as Salvador Perez. And I believe more than Alex Gordon and Billy Butler. So something close to that, but there's something ridiculous that in one game he was in the ballpark of those three. Maybe not Gordon, but...
Yeah, not Gordon. He's got...
Gordon's got like 9, 10 somewhere.
Gordon's got 14. He's second. Butler has 8. Hosmer has 7. Sal has 6.
Okay, there you go. So two less than Butler, one less than Hos, and then the same amount as Sal Perez for the season. And that was in one game.
It was one game.
So pretty impressive. We had another good showing by Yordano Ventura and James Shields both. James Shields is the man is he. I mean, no one's really talking about him because we've got Yordano Ventura, who's going crazy for a rookie, doing really well to start the season.
Yeah.
And you've got, I mean, James Shields is kind of that. We talked about him a couple weeks ago about how he's not actually an ace, and he's kind of that forgotten guy when you talk about the really good pitchers in the American League. No one ever really brings him up, but then you look at him and you look at his career and his history, and the dude has been so good and so consistent for so long. I think people just kind of take it for granted. But I mean, right now, you know, who knows if he'll be able to keep going at this pace through the rest of the season, but he's in Cy Young territory right now. This is how good of a season, good of a start he's off to. But we had a couple good starts there. I mean, what, anything jump out at you, Mike, from the last week or so with this on this road trip?
Well, I mean, you talked about Shields, and Shields looked really good. He's looked really good in his last three starts, and you know, doing everything you expect him to do at the front of that rotation. And like we talked last week, you know, maybe he's not an ace, but as we kind of concluded, you know, he's right in that territory. He's right there in that next tier. And you're right. It's easy to take that for granted because he's not really flashy. You know, a guy like, you know, Jose Fernandez is, you know, he's got that wicked slider and he's got a little bit of color and personality to him. So it's easy to kind of, you know, get on board him with him. And he's young. So, you know, he's a new face on the scene. And guys like Verlander have been dominant for so long that they stick out. But Shields just is always kind of blended in, you know, guy from Tampa, guy from Kansas City, you know, and he's not a guy that really draws a ton of attention to himself out there, you know, on the mound. He gets fired up, but, you know, they don't really do, they talk about his leadership so much, not so much, you know, any kind of gestures or anything like that. So that's what stands out is his performance. And Ventura has looked, you know, he had the one start where he got hit a little bit against Minnesota, but, you know, career high in innings, looked fantastic against Cleveland and really, or was it Cleveland or it was Baltimore?
Yeah, it was the opener against Baltimore.
Yeah, it was against Baltimore. And really, you know, we talk about his fastball so much that it's hard to forget that he's also learning how to pitch. In that game against Baltimore, he was really sharp. He had command of all three of his pitches. But the thing that he did that was interesting was he didn't really break out the changeup the first time through the order.
If he's going to be an elite pitcher in this league, it'll be the changeup that brings him there.
Yeah, and it looked like a complete game plan for him to get by on just the fastball and curveball the first time through the lineup and then start to mix the changeup in, which is what you kind of want to do. You want to hold something back so that second time through, you can throw in another element that they have to prepare for. When the guy's already throwing 102 and has that 12-6 curveball that he can locate in the zone or put it in the dirt, I mean, that's impressive. That's a weapon. And, you know, that shows, you know, command, shows discipline, and it shows some intelligence in how he's approaching that lineup. And it's really impressive to see that. And through, you know, his four starts, he's been better than advertised even.
I mean, that game, you're talking about how he kind of learned to pitch. And part of that is just watching him, you wouldn't, if you looked at the stat line, there's no way you'd be able to tell, but just watching him, he didn't have his best stuff really. I mean, it wasn't blowing people away with that fastball. Like he got, especially the first couple innings, it seemed like people were making some decent contact. He had some people on base in the first two or three innings. He struggled with that a little bit, but then he just started, like you said, it's kind of that learning to pitch, getting into a bit of a groove and learning how to deal with not having your absolute best stuff, which he hasn't, you know, as a young pitcher, that's what you always want to see. When someone isn't at necessarily the top of their game, can they still pitch and can they still be dominant? And he was. And when you can, like, that is a scary thought for everybody else, and mm-hmm. fantastic news for the Royals that he was able to do that. I mean, I have just been beyond impressed. I mean, he looks on the mound, and this is not going to be saying anything bad about someone like Danny Duffy, but he's just the most recent young Royals developed pitcher that we have that can be a comparison. So I'm going to use him. But when you saw Danny Duffy on the mound, and especially in games where he struggled a little bit, you noticed it. And it was in his body language. It was in the way he pitched. He was frustrated. He couldn't hit the zone. He would kind of pace around in between pitches. You could just tell he wasn't feeling it and he didn't know what to do. And that's part of what I think being in the bullpen is definitely going to help him with. He's going to be able to kind of learn to get through that and to move forward with it. But you don't see that from Yordano Ventura. And if there's one major factor, because they both have great stuff, but if there's one major factor that's going to separate the two moving forward, then that I think is one of the big, besides obviously the otherworldly fastball that Ventura has. I mean, Duffy throws pretty hard for a lefty, but it's not going to compare. But still, you know, that's might be the biggest factor in determining Yordano Ventura's success.
Yeah, I mean, he looks unflappable. out there. Even when he was against Minnesota, and you know, he throws 30 pitches in the first inning and had another inning where he threw like 25, 28, really got taxed by that lineup. Still limited the damage to, you know, only four runs on four innings, which isn't good, but I mean, considering that he's a rookie against a very, very patient team that is scoring kind of like crazy right now. That's a really good sign to see him come in and just limit the damage as best he can. And, you know, just looking at his numbers, I mean, he's striking out so many people. He's at almost 10 strikeouts per nine innings.
Yep.
And better than 50% ground ball rate, too. So that's pretty dangerous there if you're an opposing team to have a guy who can strike you out and will get ground balls from you. That's about as good a combination as you can get. And he's not walking a ton either. He's, you know, a little wild, but he's not anything crazy. He's 3.2 walks per nine innings, which isn't, you know, he's a rookie. That's not too bad.
Yeah. And if you look at what he's doing now, and you compare those numbers to his past history, just in strikeouts per nine, walks per nine, BABIP, and the ground ball percentage, I mean, it's pretty much in line with what he's done for most of his career through pretty much every level at the minors. I mean, he usually kind of hovers in that three range for walks per nine innings, but he's never jumped above four, and he's been able to kind of to maintain it. And I mean, right now he's got a 1.8 ERA. You know, and you said he's got 9.7 strikeouts per nine is what his actual number is. I mean, he's really lighting it up. And then we've kind of talked about some of the advanced stats before, but there's a couple that we've thrown around, and I think we've kind of explained every once in a while, but there's XFIP and FIP, which is FIP being fielding independent pitching, more or less trying to eliminate, basically normalizes the pitcher's statistics for your average defense, and then tries to say, okay, well, how is the pitcher doing at the things that he can control? And his numbers are still really good in that area. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the best thing, not only are the numbers good, but they look sustainable, which is the best part. So,
he is must watch pitching right now.
It's appointment television, you know, it's like Breaking Bad is going out to watch Yordano Ventura pitch. It's fantastic. And I'm just so excited to have, I was talking about this with my dad. Maybe you can help with this. Maybe since Carlos Beltran might be the only one that I can think of off the top of my head, but when was the last time the Royals had, and this is no given, obviously, but it's just a possibility that if Yordano Ventura continues this way for his rookie year and then moves forward and goes until he's a free agent and continues to climb that ladder of elite pitching, I mean, when was the last player that the Royals developed and brought up had major success as a rookie and continued it on for the full time until they became a free agent? Because if Yordano Ventura continues the way he's going, the Royals will never be able to sign him, ever.
Yeah, they pretty much have to get to like August and then get that the Sal Perez kind of deal.
Yeah.
Basically all they can do right now is just try to get him there.
Yeah, if they can lock him up for one of those $30 million 5-year contracts with three option years or whatever it is, then
do it.
Absolutely do that in a heartbeat. But if they can't, then you know they won't be able to sign him, which, you know, whatever. But I mean, can you think, because you look at just even the current team now, you know, Hosmer struggled big time in 2012. Moustakas has struggled his entire career. Gordon had his issues the first 3 years. Butler, he came up, had a good rookie year. Then the next year, he had to go back down to the minors because he struggled a little bit. I mean, has there been anyone that you can remember in recent history that could just from the get-go kind of be a phenom?
Well, even Greinke struggled his first couple of years before, you know, everything where he left and then he came back and then
he was 5-17 one year. I mean, I'm not a huge win loss record guy, but I mean, he had the ERA and all the stats to back that up.
I mean, he was getting hit a lot, and he's always been a fly ball guy. So that's always a problem. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you would almost have to go back Let's see. Angel Burrow won Rookie of the Year. Definitely not him.
Hamlin, Bob Hamlin.
Bob Hamlin.
Not him.
Probably not him. Yeah. I mean, I would say you might go back to like Tom Gordon, Kevin Apier.
Yeah.
You might have to go back into like 89.
Kevin Seitzer, maybe.
Yeah, Seitzer was really...
He wasn't ever elite, but, you know, he had success from... I guess I'd have to go back and look.
He was a 200-hit guy every year for a couple of years, so...
Yeah.
That's pretty good. And yeah, I mean, I would say probably Apier is probably the closest. The guy who, you know, came up in 89, and I think he pitched that September, and then... Or maybe he was 90. But anyway, you know, within a couple of years, he was a Cy Young candidate, and really, in 93... I'll still say this. He should have won the Cy Young Award because he was better than Jack McDowell, but whatever.
And he's, I mean, there have been numerous articles written from multiple sources talking about how he is a borderline Hall of Fame candidate and probably the most underappreciated pitcher of the 90s.
Oh, yeah. And,
I mean, you any way you want to slice it, we never realized how good he was because he was on a lot of really bad teams. I wouldn't say really bad. He wasn't quite in the really bad era. He left before then, but he was on some teams that struggled. Yeah. And he
really average teams.
Yeah. And he was very above average. So that's a different topic for a different show.
Yeah.
But the and another thing that's important, just to kind of put a final thought on the Yordano Ventura thing, the first game that he pitched that we talked about against the Orioles set a career high in innings, like Mike said, of 8 innings, and then 8 strikeouts, which is also a career high. And just the fact that he did it against the Orioles, who, I mean, they've been lighting it up.
Yeah, going into that series, they'd scored 24 runs in 3 games against the Blue Jays, and then they run into Ventura and shuts them out.
Who was it that pitched after Ventura? Was it...
That was Guthrie, yeah. And he had a decent start.
I think he gave up 2 runs in the first inning and then really kind of settled in and went 6 deep, I think. But even that game, they only scored they ended up winning extra innings, but only scored 3 runs. And then the next day, Royals went 8-2. So they held them to, 7 runs in 3 games when they had scored, like he said, 24, the 3 before that. So, I mean, that was an impressive showing. Granted, 2 of those pitchers were Ventura and Shields, but all the same, I mean, it's the Orioles are, and for the last couple of years, have been a very talented offensive team. So that was a pretty good showing by the Royals to kind of keep them down. But on the flip side, a not very good showing was the 4 games prior to that, where they played the Indians. And the Indians are the team, everyone talks about the Tigers because they've won the division the last few years. But the Indians are, you know, target area number 1. The Royals got to step over them before they can step over the Tigers, because the Indians finished ahead of them last year. Everyone kind of forgets about that, but the Indians were in the playoffs. So you need to make up some ground on the teams that you want to be better than. And a 4-game opportunity is a really good time to do that. And the Royals did not do that. They went 1-3. Granted, it was in Cleveland, but all the same, you know, you'd at least like to split that. I mean, what are your thoughts? What are your takeaways from the 4-game series they had in Cleveland?
Well, 2 of those games were really winnable that they had lost, and, you know, really kind of disappointed that they couldn't pull them out. But, you know, the biggest kind of issue was you saw about as bad as the Royals can get in that. Well, I guess you didn't see it because I don't think it was broadcast, but it was that Thursday game that started at like 11 in the morning Central Time. And I was, it was done by like, you know, 1:30. So, where Corey Kluber just tore him apart, you know, and like 101 pitches.
Complete game, the whole deal.
11 strikeouts, you know, really just dominated him. And the Royals didn't seem interested at all in putting up a fight. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that the Indians have to kind of get that kind of performance from those guys. And that's what they got last year, where, you know, Ubaldo Jimenez had an excellent second half, and Scott Kazmir came out and saw his old, you know, his old kind of style and self, rejuvenated his career with them. And they had Michael Bourne and Nick Swisher and even Jason Giambi contributed. So a lot of those guys were, you know, a big part of their kind of surge last year, or Cleveland, I think they made like a 24-game turnaround and made the playoffs. And this year, I mean, yeah, until the Royals show any reason why they should jump over them, they still have to go do it. In a situation like this where you can go in to Cleveland and have a chance to win two of those games, you know, the one game that they won, you know, the bats were awake and they won 8-2, and that's great. But when you get into that spot where you have a winnable game to open the series and they don't win it, and then you have a winnable game after a win, you really need to win those games. And it's, you know, the thing with the Royals, they only scored 3 runs in each of those games, and that's kind of the thing. It's cliched, but it's also coming up true where when they've scored 4 or more runs, they win the game. And when they score fewer than that, they haven't. And so that's really kind of what you have to do. You have to see at least average offensive production from this team. And they didn't have it in Cleveland. They did a lot better about that in Baltimore and were able to rebound and take that series before coming home. But yeah, Cleveland, I mean, those are games you got to win. It's like when they opened the season in Detroit, you go to Detroit and they had some winnable games, you know, that you got to win those too. And those, the easiest way for them to stake their claim on the AL Central is to beat the opponents in the Central. And they're not doing that as well as they need to right now.
Yeah, and you can lump that second game that they dropped to the Orioles in that same kind of category. You know, when we look back in August and the Royals are, call it, 5 games back with, you know, 30 to play or however many, and they need to make up that ground, we're going to look back and say, I mean, everyone kind of said, oh, you know, it's early, it's only April, blah, blah, blah. Well, games in April, they count the same as they do in September. You know, we've said that before on this show, and it's obviously true. So we could look back and say there's a handful of games in April alone that the Royals really just maybe shouldn't have even lost. That, I mean, you're going to go through a season with every team, and you're going to have games that get away from you that you shouldn't have lost, you know, so on and so forth. But it just seems like already the Royals have had a lot. And if you're a team with a small margin of error like the Royals, and you've got to have a good record in those one run games. And I don't know offhand, but I know that I was keeping track for a while, and I'd have to look it up now. But I know that the Royals record in one run games is not that great right now. And because if you look at the Baltimore Orioles in 2012, who they had similar big turnaround to what the Indians did last year. And one of their big defining factors that season was their record in one run games. They had a really, really good record in the one run games. And so that's, you know, the Royals need to kind of step that up in order to try and take that next step, because right now it's just not working for them. And that's going to be a big factor as they keep moving in the season. They need to win those tight games.
Yep, they definitely do. And I think they have the pitching and defense to do it. I mean, they're sitting at 500 and they're getting nothing from most of the people on offense. So that's about as positive as you can really get, you know, because they're doing this with hardly anything from Billy Butler, very little from Mike Moustakas. I mean, he's hit the homers and everything, and he's driven in some runs, but really, other than that, he really hasn't been much of a contributor. Eric Hosmer doesn't have a homer. Billy Butler doesn't have a homer. Alex Gordon has one. Sal Perez has one. So they're not getting a lot from those guys, and it's they're still able to kind of hang around in the middle. I mean, I think, you know, if you didn't get this out of their defense and out of their pitching, they would be, you know, 7-17 at this stage, because they would have no other way to get around and win any kind of games, because their defense wouldn't be there, or their pitching wouldn't be there, or what have you. And so I guess that's a positive, but it's still kind of tough to say, okay, they're at 500 now and that's a positive. But, you know, given what they've done on offense, it could be a lot worse. And I guess that's kind of what you have to take right now.
Yeah, and I misspoke earlier. I think when I said at the beginning of the show, I think I said they were 12-11. They're 12-12, so that was my mistake there. But I pulled it up here while you were talking, and the Royals are 2-6 so far in one-run games. First of all, That means a third of their games have been one runs, and that seems like a lot to me, but I'd have to look at the numbers to see how that stacks up against other teams, because I'm not certain right offhand if that's right around league average. But a third of your games being decided by one run seems like a little much, but like I said, I'll have to look that up to see. But I mean, they're 2-6 in those one run games, so that needs to improve, because if that were to hold true the whole season, then that means they're going to be, you're going to have 50 some odd one run games. And if they only win 25% of them, and you're looking at like a 15-35 record in those games, and you just can't have that. So that'll be, you know, something to watch going forward, and we'll see how that shakes out. But we're going to go ahead and take our first break now. And then when we come back, we're going to drop some knowledge on you guys about the Royals and the myth or fact of Kauffman's home run suppressing power. So we will see you on the other side.
Kelly's Westport Inn has been a Kansas City tradition for generations. But now, you can be part of a new tradition brought to you by Kelly's and the friendly neighbors at McCoy's. On Sunday, May 25th, come on out to the third annual Kelly's and McCoy's Block Party. Bring a friend, meet new friends. You can dance by yourself. We don't care. It's whatever makes you happy. There's just a $5 cover charge to get into the best outdoor party in Westport, and the fun starts at 8 p.m. Come out and enjoy the warm spring air and the best entertainment district the city has to offer. And while you're sipping on a refreshing beverage, in moderation, of course, enjoy the sounds of Lost Wax. We take the stage at 9:30 and we'll be playing long into the night. I mean, you're off on Memorial Day already, right? It's everything you could want. Great weather, great atmosphere, and the great people of Kansas City. And even better, you've got Lost Wax playing all your favorite tunes. That's on May 25th, starting at 8 p.m., the third annual Kelly's and McCoy's Block Party.
And welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault. I am your host, the Kansas City Baseball Vault, presented by Kelly's Westport Inn. I am your host, Jeff Herr, and with me, of course, is Michael Engel. The first segment, we got you caught up on a little Royals action, what's been happening the last week or so, and things, the good things and the bad. And one thing we touched on in last week's show that kind of took on a little bit of a life of its own, if you will, and not only in the show last week, but then this week, Michael Engel devoted a ton of time to compiling a lot of different stats that really showed the question of home runs in Kauffman Stadium. Is it a myth? Is it a reality? Does Kauffman suppress home runs? I think we all kind of agree that it does to a certain extent, but my hang-up was that the Royals present Kauffman Stadium like this Everest of home run hitting, this insurmountable force that no matter who you have, Steve Balboni will not be toppled. He will not be denied his Royals home run record. Like, it's just impossible to hit 36 home runs, and I just flat out don't buy it. You know, you have people that, you know, what was it, Jack Maloof last year, who came out and said, you know, oh, you're not going to hit home runs in this ballpark, when just a few months before in the offseason, the Royals said, we're going to concentrate on hitting more home runs because we have to. We have to do that to be a better team. And when it didn't happen last year, they started making excuses. And Jack Maloof said, you can't hit home runs in Kauffman, and we're not even trying. We could, you know, we'll... What was his quote? Do you remember?
There were two parts to it, and one of them was that they weren't going to, like, other teams would come in and their swings would be tailored to their stadiums where it's easier to hit home runs, but the Royals don't have that luxury to swing the same way for the fences, and so it just wasn't going to happen, which is okay, I guess. And then he also said, The money quote was, we're going to lead the league in fewest home runs.
That's like, the one I was looking at.
What?
Okay.
What kind of Orwellian double speak is that crap?
Yeah, we call that a self-fulfilling prophecy where you're building in an excuse so that when you fail, you don't have to worry about trying to explain it because, well, I told you we were going to lead the league in fewest home runs because that's how it is in Kauffman Stadium and all that BS. So Mike really took we kind of spitballed what we wanted to really look into and what we think would kind of shed more light on this topic. Am I just being an ass and attacking the Royals because that's what I like to do? Or do I have a legitimate point? Is there a difference, or is there really no difference in Kauffman Stadium? And the Royals just haven't drafted, required, or developed many home run hitters. So I'm going to kind of throw it to Mike here, and you can kind of go down what you found here because it's some really interesting stuff about the, if you will, the different eras of Kauffman Stadium and how the Royals have stacked up.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of information that I dug up. And, it's very clear that if the Royals have a guy like Steve Balboni as their home run leader, and that record was set in 1985, nearly 30 years ago, I mean, the easy assumption is that, okay, there's, you know, like I said last week, the common element in all of these kind of problems, you know, even under Herc Robinson, under John Scherholz, under Allard Baird, under Dayton Moore, under all these guys, it's all been the stadium. And, you know, the one conclusion that I can come to is that, I mean, and this is intuitive, you know, it makes sense because Kauffman is a bigger stadium, that it is tougher to hit home runs at Kauffman Stadium than in other stadiums. And that part, you know, I don't think anybody would be surprised by that. But it is a little surprising to see kind of the comparison between what teams will hit at home versus on the road. So I kind of looked at a lot of different splits over a lot of different periods of time to figure out, okay, what did the Royals hit at home over these years? What did they hit on the road over these years? And when you really break it down year by year, looking at what the Royals did as a team, they hit home runs at home 6 years out of 42 at Kauffman Stadium. Six times that they went ahead and actually they had more home runs at Kauffman Stadium than they did on the road. And the really interesting part of that, which I don't think would be too big of a surprise either, is that of those 6 years, five of them came in the years between 95 and 2003 when the Royals had moved the fences in 10 feet. So essentially under the actual dimensions of Kauffman Stadium and since, you know, 2004, the fences have been back to be about 387 in both of the alleys and then 410 to center. With those dimensions, Kauffman Stadium has been pretty much, the Royals have not hit more home runs at Kauffman other than 1976, which is, you know, one of their best years ever. So it's pretty clear that Kauffman Stadium has a very big effect on what the Royals' home run output is going to be. Now, the kind of idea that I wanted to run with is, how does that compare with the league, and how does that compare to other players in Kauffman Stadium? And then I even went so far as to just break it down by, you know, different periods of time. So, you know, we've got the years up to when Balboni set the record. That's kind of an arbitrary point, but I think it also will illustrate that, okay, here's the period where the Royals had opportunities to break his record of 36, and here's how they performed in those years. So I think that's it's the most arbitrary period, but the easiest periods to look at are, you know, before the fences moved, when the fences were moved in, and then after they had moved them back. And also in 95, when they moved the fences in, they lowered them by 3 feet. So the fences used to be 12 feet high and, you know, 387 into the gaps and 410 straightaway center field. So it's easy to see why you wouldn't be able to hit a home run there. So that's not, you know, a surprise. So I think the first element, yes, Kauffman Stadium is a very home run suppressing environment, and you know the numbers will back that up even when you compare the what the Royals have done and what other players have done relative to, you know, what the regular league average of in this case I looked at plate appearances per home run. And so, you know, pretty much down the line, when you've got even comparing what the Royals gave up versus what they hit, the rate is a lot worse. So a greater number of plate appearances per home run in Kauffman Stadium versus any other stadium but Kauffman Stadium. So that part is, I would say, confirmed completely. And you look at the park factors year by year, and it's going to tell you the same kind of thing. Fences in, fences back, whatever. For the most part, they're generally going to be – well, I'll take that back. When the fences were in, it was also a period where the Royals had no pitching. So they did give up more home runs
yes.
at Kauffman Stadium than what the league typically would have done. But in some cases, up through 1994 in Kauffman Stadium, I mean, you're looking at a 15 plate appearance per home run difference. So that's a significant amount. You know, I don't have like a standard deviation on this, but you know, you can just look at the numbers, and I'm going to put these on Pine Tar Press later on, probably this weekend, so that people can really look at the numbers in each era and kind of compare. But it's very clear that Kauffman Stadium is a much more difficult place to hit home runs. Like I said, 6 years out of 42, the Royals have hit, you know, more home runs on the road than at home. Royals pitchers in 1973, when the stadium opened, when it was Royals Stadium, they gave up more home runs at home in Kansas City than they did on the road. It's the only year that ever happened. So the only time. So there have been home or away, no matter who's up, only, you know, seven seasons essentially out of what you could say is 84. If you look at what they hit versus what the Royals hit, seven times did a team hit more home runs in Kauffman Stadium than any other place. So that's very, very much a function of the stadium. And it makes a lot of sense because, you know, from 73 to 94, the Royals had turf. And like you brought up last week, Jeff, you know, they really tailored their team to that stadium. And they brought in guys like Frank White, who's athletic, quick, you know, wasn't a power guy. George Brett, who hit the ball hard, gap to gap, all over the place, had enough power because he hit it hard enough, but you know, he wasn't there to hit it over the fence. He was there to hit it hard. Willie Wilson, who is one of the fastest players in baseball history, you know, Cookie Rojas, Freddie Patek, all those guys throughout the years that were, you know, really speedy guys, and they really relied on the dimensions of the stadium to not only play great defense and cover a lot of ground, but also to, you know, be the guy to hit the ball on the turf and let it skip far enough so that you can turn a single into a double into a triple. You know, there are a couple of years where the Royals were far and away hitting more triples than every other team because they were balls that probably would have been homers in other places. And so, you know, it hits 10 feet up the fence, 409 feet away from home plate. Yeah, that's a hard hit ball, but it's not going to go out at Kauffman Stadium. Whereas if you're in Baltimore or Milwaukee or something like that, it might. And so, you know, that's kind of one of those things in play. And with those original fences and you know, from 73 to 94, you know, the Royals, it would take them 62 plate appearances to hit a home run. Versus during that same period, you're looking at about 46 and a half plate appearances to hit a home run on the road with those same, you know, over that span of 22 seasons. So it's pretty clear there that Kauffman was a really big part of that kind of issue. And the only time you really see a big jump is, you know, in what the Royals were able to do and where they get really close to hitting about league average at their home run rate is when they move the fences in. And, you know, when it's a little more standard to what the rest of the stadiums in baseball are looking like, you know, the league average over those years was about 35, 36 plate appearances per homer. The Royals were at about 42. So there's still a little bit of that element of, you know, is it the players or is it the stadium? So I think the second part of that would also be kind of true, that the Royals really haven't brought in a lot of players that they see as home run hitters. And I think the kind of point we were looking at last time was more looking at Dayton Moore and what we're looking at there. And so one of those periods that I looked at was what I'll call the Dayton Moore era, which I'm calling it 2007 to the present, even though I think you could consider part of 2006, but he didn't really do a lot of acquisitions in 2006 that, you know, it was a lost season anyway. So 2007,
to say the least,
to the present. Yeah. You know, it's very consistent with what the Royals have done all time at Kauffman Stadium. And at the same rate, it's still far below what the league usually does. So all time, Royals have hit a home run at Kauffman Stadium, 54.29 plate appearances per home run. Under Dayton Moore since 2007, 54.18 at Kauffman Stadium. So it's right in line. And I don't know how you can really compare the players, because it's also, you've got the problem of players nowadays are, home runs are incentivized a lot more. It's a lot bigger part of the game. You know, the game's a lot more of a three true outcomes game than it was in 1976. So that's a difficult part to kind of look at. But at the same time, it also seems like the players that the Royals do have who could potentially be those kind of home run threats are also, they're performing pretty poorly at hitting home runs better than anybody else, because Alex Gordon, you know, all-world athlete and everything, he's really only hit three home runs more at, let me re-say that properly. he's actually hit more home runs at Kauffman than he has on the road. Billy Butler's the same way. And what that kind of suggests to me is that you would expect those guys to go in and have a wide gap between what they hit on the road versus at home. And so I think that suggests to me that these guys just aren't going to be home run hitters in just about any stadium you have, unless you're in very specific conditions like, you know, Butler and Fenway. That'd be interesting to see. Butler in Texas with that jet stream where he hit, you know, right in his money, you know, that right center jet stream. Yep. That could be interesting. Alex Gordon in Yankee Stadium. That could be something of interest. But unless you're looking at, you know, just specific stadiums, I don't see a lot of these guys really doing a whole lot, you know, otherwise. And really, the gap isn't that big. You know, with those guys, like I said, it's two or three homers where, you know, you've got Butler's got 100-some and Gordon's right in there. You know, with Eric Hosmer, he's got 29 on the road and 21 at home. So that's looking, starting to get into a pretty white split. But
yeah,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, I think one of the things that you touched on that I thought was most interesting is just, you know, if you looking at the road numbers, because if we were to try and just compare Kauffman and non-Kauffman, like obviously there's a big difference. So we do know, you know, we knew, and I don't think that it was any surprise that Kauffman is suppressing things, but just still, and kind of the point that you just made more or less, that the road numbers still don't quite match up to the league numbers. There was only, of these eras that you've divided out here, you know, there were only roughly two eras where the Royals were actually better than league average, or their road average was better than the league average in terms of plate appearances per home runs. So, yeah, I mean, am I right or are the Royals right? You know, I think it's kind of both, which is interesting. Really.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, I mean, Kauffman makes it more difficult, but the Royals aren't helping themselves either.
Right. And I think that's one of the fun nuances of the game is that, yeah, I mean, Kauffman Stadium is a difficult place to hit home runs, but I think you could also find people who can hit home runs there. You know, you look at some of the guys who have come in from other teams. You know, Paul Konerko's hit, you know, a good amount of homers in Kauffman Stadium, and guys like A-Rod and Pujols and you know, even Justin Morneau and guys who are, you know, Miguel Cabrera, guys who are elite home run guys, elite hitters, mm-hmm. have no problem with Kauffman Stadium. I mean, there's no issue with it because it's just another stadium. You know, they're guys who are going to, they could hit a home run in the Grand Canyon because they're just that good. And the Royals aren't either pursuing those guys, they're getting unlucky when they draft those guys, or they're not developing them to be those guys. So I think that's a fair point to also make, is that the personnel on the field, and, you know, the Royals are a very contact-dependent and contact-focused team, you know, top to bottom. I mean, they want their guys like Eric Hosmer to be able to put the ball in play. They want Billy Butler to put it in play. Mm-hmm. You know, they get guys like Sal Perez who will put anything in play, and They acquired Unieski Betancourt, who had one of the better contact rates in baseball when they got him. Not that it's good contact, but you know, he didn't swing and miss that much. And even now, what they went and got in Nori Aoki and Omar Infante, I mean, they were talking up, you know, how those guys never strike out, and really making that a really key point after the transactions to really say, hey, this is going to be great at the top of our lineup because these guys make contact all the time. So, I mean, it's always been that way. And you know, I can kind of see it because, you know, in the turf days, you put that ball on the ground and forget it. I mean, you get a Baltimore chop on the turf at Old Royal Stadium. Done, you know, unless it is Balboni himself, you probably got a guy on first base.
Yeah.
You know, just because they were fast enough, or a guy like Brett who didn't really have great speed, but you know, you ran out of the box like his hair was on fire. So it makes sense, I guess, because that's kind of the culture of the team all the time. But it's also interesting that it does continue throughout different generations, because I mean, like I said, the Royals have had a number of general managers and a lot of different managers in the dugout and a lot of different hitting coaches, and nobody really seems to try to hit home runs. And so maybe it is that they just recognize that they have guys going to the plate who aren't going to hit home runs at the kind of rates that you would want to see from Curtis Granderson, who's another good home run guy, or, you know, even Justin Morneau. I think I mentioned Michael Kadire hit a lot of home runs at Kauffman Stadium. You know, guys like that just come up and they can hit a home run no matter where they're at. And the Royals don't seem to have those guys.
Yeah.
Or at worst, they're not developing them to be those guys.
Yeah. And to that end, I looked up three players, and got this from Hit Tracker Online, where you can actually look at all the home runs that a player has hit, and then you can overlay Kauffman Stadium's measurements on
awesome
there.
Site.
So it's really, really cool. But anyway, and it's run by ESPN. But anyway, I wanted to take three examples. And one that I've got was I took the home run leader from last year was Chris Davis. He had 53 home runs. So overlaid Kauffman Stadium. And anything that was even close, like basically what this does is it puts out a standard field in a graph format, X, Y axis type of thing, and then puts a red line where Kauffman's wall is. So any dot that represents a home run that touched the wall, I took out. And so Chris Davis hit 53 home runs last year. And of those 53, 13 of them would not have been out in Kauffman Stadium. Now, that is being extremely conservative because there are a couple that just barely are touching the line that represents the wall, and it's on the other side, so they probably still would have been out. But if we'll be completely conservative, and we'll take those out no matter what. And that's still 40 home runs. Boom. New Royals record right there. The number two hitter in the American League for home runs last year was Miguel Cabrera, who hit 44. I did the same thing for him. There are nine of those scenarios in which it probably would not, or most could not have, might not have been a home run in Kauffman Stadium. So you take those out, that's 35. That's not a record, but if someone hit 35 home runs, he'd be a national hero here in Kansas City. And then I looked at Jose Bautista, who the Royals had for a brief stint of time,
like,
and gave up
games
on.
In 2004.
And I mean, I don't blame the Royals for that at all, because there's a lot of teams that passed up on Jose
Four
Bautista.
Other teams that year passed on him.
So, I mean, I don't blame the Royals, but it's always funny when you can say that a team had somebody and then didn't even give them a chance, and then here they explode. But you look at his 2010 for Jose Bautista, he had 54 home runs. I'm sorry, 53 home runs, just like Chris Davis did. And then, or like Chris Davis did last year. And there were 12 that he had that wouldn't have been a home run. So this, I mean, what does this do? This confirms what your numbers showed as well, that Kauffman does suppress home runs, but it's not impossible. And there are three scenarios where, I mean, what's been in the last 10 years, what's the biggest, the most home runs to lead this league? It's been Butler's 29, right? To lead the team. because I can't think of the last person to hit 30 was Jermaine Dye in 2000.
Yeah, it would have been the 29 by Butler in 2012, which...
Yeah, so that's, I mean, so those three examples right there. Now, granted, those are sluggers, you know, home run hitting type players, but that's what we want. That's what we're kind of talking about still.
Mm-hmm.
And Billy Butler, Alex Gordon, Eric Hosmer, they're supposed to be similar to those type of guys. And that's three times that you could have taken those three seasons and put them anywhere in the last 10 years, and they would have led the team by at least six home runs. The next step that we can't answer, no matter how much research that we do, how many numbers we want to throw at you, is the question of whether Dayton Moore, Allard Baird, Sherholtz, whoever the GM is, are they going out there and are they specifically saying, I mean, you talked about what the Royals say publicly, how they talk about getting these contact guys that don't strike out and all that kind of stuff. But, I mean, do they truly go out and say, we don't want Ryan Howard because he hits home runs and we want guys that are more contact hitters and he strikes out too much? Do we not want Jose Bautista because he strikes out too much? He's a home run hitter, fly ball hitter. You know, is that really the mentality that they take? Do they really go out there and say, we have to have guys that can keep the ball down and we're going to sacrifice some home runs because of it? You know, I mean, it seems that way. And the way what they present to the public, it kind of falls in line with that line of thinking. But it's hard for me to fathom and to accept that the Royals truly go out there and say, we're not looking for home run power, we're looking for something else, and that's the kind of player that we want and that we target. Like, I just find that hard to believe. I mean, if you're looking at all this and hearing what we hear, and as much as we think and discuss and talk about the Royals, do you ultimately get the feeling that they're out there just kind of passing over these big home run guys because maybe they think, oh, well, it's a fly ball guy and fly ball guys don't do well in Kauffman? I mean, do you think that's where they come out on this?
I think it might be, because if you're talking about guys like Bautista and like Howard, who are, you know, basically all or nothing guys, and you have a stadium, an environment where you're going to play half your games where some of those balls won't be leaving the fence, that does cut into what value they might be able to, you know, get out of them at the plate. And so that could be, you know, 10 balls that don't leave the yard that turn into outs, which isn't a whole lot, but at the same time, I mean, that's 10 runs. That's, you know, even if there's guys on base, that could be 15 to 20 runs. And so I could see them avoiding them in a way, but I don't know if it would be pronounced enough because, you know, like when you were talking about the overlay from Hit Tracker, I mean, even though Chris Davis hit 53 homers and what was it, 13 got taken back conservatively, just, you know, being kind of, you know, mean to Chris Davis about it. Even that's assuming that he would play all of his games in Kauffman Stadium and he still hits 40 out. You know, that doesn't count the games that he goes to Fenway, that he goes to Baltimore, that he goes to Toronto, that he goes to, you know, wherever else where the dimensions are going to be a lot friendlier. So maybe it only costs 5 home runs. And in a way, if you're getting a guy who could hit 40 home runs, you know, that produces a lot for a team. And it really does. It says to me that the effect is going to be there. But if you have a true guy who can put up that kind of power, I don't know that it's that big of a detriment to go get him just because a few might not leave the yard. Because there are still going to be some that will hit the wall. There's still going to be some that'll go all the way up, you know, that a fielder still can't get to, even if it maybe stays in the park. You still might get a double out of some of those. So I think it's tough to say because it's nothing that's ever happened, obviously. So it's tough to really like pin anything on them. But I would say, yeah, that they probably are trying to avoid some of those guys. And maybe it is something where they pursue those guys, but the hitters don't want to come here knowing that it's going to be difficult. So, I mean, it could be a little bit of that too. So I don't know. I mean, there's a ton of factors involved, but I think if the Royals are going at it and saying that, you know, we want this high contact guy and we're okay if he doesn't have a ton of power because our stadium's not going to be good, well, you're still kind of missing out because even a guy who has marginal power like Billy Butler over the last few years, even if he's only a 20 home run guy, he's still got potential to be a 40, 50 double guy. And that's still a very valuable hitter, you know, which Butler has shown from 2009 through last year. He's a very valuable hitter, even though he's not the home run guy that people want him to be. You know, George Brett was never a home run guy. He was always the same kind of doubles, triples guy that hit the ball hard all the time. And a lot of times they would go out, but he only hit 30 homers one time. Edgar Martinez, same thing. He only hit 30 home runs one time. So, you know, I think you could still find guys who have value, even if they're not home run guys. And so I think if they're avoiding guys because they think that they might strike out too much and the home runs won't outweigh it, I think that's a mistake.
Yeah, and that's, you know, you brought up an interesting wrinkle of, well, you know, this the exercise I did with the hit tracker stuff is assuming that every home run is hit at Kauffman, which it's not. So you're gonna balance out even more and kind of tip more towards the higher side. So instead of 40 from Chris Davis or 41 from Jose Bautista, you know, it's maybe more in the 45 range. And so then let's play that out. You know, if you're the Royals and you don't, if you're the Royals and you're thinking, okay, you know, thinking from the first line of thought, where just everything, if we're trying to assume everything would be in Kauffman to see what the difference might be on the most extreme end of the scale, then you're looking at 12 more outs than what that player already produced. But then you got to play it out, say,
in 700 plate appearances.
Yeah, are those 12 out? But then even still, you've got 12 outs. So let's take Jose Bautista. He had 53 home runs. 12 would not have been out in Kauffman Stadium, assuming they're all in Kauffman. So he's down to 41 home runs now. But that's still 12 more than not even the average over Dayton Moore's era for home runs by a player. But the leader, the most by far, 29 home runs. So that's still 12 more. So you're getting 12 more outs than that player actually produced, theoretically, but you're also getting 12 more home runs than your leading home run producer produced. And who knows how many RBIs that is, you know, depending on how many people are in base ahead of them and so forth. So, I mean, like you said, there are a lot of factors here, but I'm with you that I think it's just an absolute mistake to try and think that, I mean, Kauffman is different, but it's a mistake to try and play to that, because you're going to do one of two things. You're going to miss out on home run hitters, or you're going to, I guess if you're the Royals case, you're going to do two of two things, but you're going to miss out on home run hitters, and you're going to maybe place some unnecessary pressure on players to change the way that they hit mm-hmm. and play to the park. Because we talked about self-fulfilling prophecy. Well, when you're the Royals and you're an organization, you know, you hear things like losing culture and winning culture and things like that. I mean, I think a lot of the locker room talk and all that kind of stuff is more or less, you know, whatever. I don't think you need to be all buddy-buddy in the locker room to actually win games, but that's a different topic. But the idea of a culture, I think I do believe in quite a bit. And if you, as an organization, basically ever since your existence, have been saying, well, you know, you just can't hit home runs in Kauffman, you know, oh, shucks, it's just darn hard, you know? I mean, that's what they've been saying. They say it to us. I'm sure they say it to the players, you know, like, oh, don't worry, Haas, you know, that would have been out in a lot of parks. You just got to keep aiming for those gaps, things like that. I mean, when you hear this and it just comes down on you all the time as a player, that's got to have an effect. Yeah, I mean, that's why my dream for the next GM after Dayton Moore is to somebody to come in and say, no, I'm not messing with that anymore, because it's not a factor. It is something. I mean, I shouldn't say that it's not a factor, but we're not gonna use that as an excuse anymore, yeah. Because we can have players that can hit 40 home runs in this ballpark, and it can be done. It's just, we've got to find the right players, and we've got to have the right approach. And we need, you know, it's similar to when Nolan Ryan came in to Texas,
yep.
And he kind of more or less threw the idea of pitch counts and inning limits and all that kind of stuff aside where it was, you know, we're not going to mess with this anymore because we're going to listen to the pitcher. He's going to tell us. And, you know, it's kind of that old adage, the hitter will tell you when a pitcher's ready to come out of the game. So that's what I want, you know, and we're not hearing it from this regime, and we won't hear it from this regime. So I want, that's my dream for the next GM, whenever that may be and whenever that happens. So, you know, who knows, but it's been frustrating for me for a long time to have to listen to the organization try and trump this up. Like, it's just something, and it's we've shown that it, while it may be a factor, it's not something that can't be overcome. And the organization needs to change to realize that.
Yep. And there's one thing, one more kind of comparison that I'll throw out, and then I'm kind of out of data, but,
Never.
I mean, in the 42 years, 42 different seasons, including up to now, the Royals have been, well, I won't include 2014 in this, just because it's such a small amount of home runs, basically. But if you look at the Royals and comparing their home runs to their road home runs, in the Dayton Moore era, in four of those seasons since 2007, the Royals' home run totals have been at least within 10 of their road home run totals. So that gap is kind of shrunk in there. Whereas if you look down the line, and especially, you know, just ignore the years where the fences were in, you know, every other year, it's pretty much at least 10 or more home runs being hit on the road than at home. So he's kind of evened it up that way. So I guess that's a feather in his cap. It's a tough sell on that, but there has been some almost progress to at least even it up to the point where, you know, they're able to hit home runs a little more consistently, at least from a counting standpoint, not necessarily a rate standpoint.
Home to the road. And if anything, all that goes to show is that at some point it is about the player, because if that's something that he's consciously tried to do and tried to even out home road splits in terms of home runs that are hit per plate or just in general, then if that can be, you know, more or less evened out, then you would think that that means you can find a player who's not going to have a huge split. And therefore, if they can hit home runs, then they can hit,
in Kauffman Stadium.
In Kauffman Stadium.
Yeah, it's like, so I said last time, 410 is 410 everywhere.
Exactly.
So, I mean, if you can hit it 410 feet, you're pretty much going to get it out of every single stadium in baseball, unless you hit it straightaway center field in some places. But generally, you know, it's going to work.
That's why Maloof's statement was almost backwards, because you think, well, the Royals, I mean, if they're trained to hit home runs more or less on 410, but obviously the organization we know doesn't really teach that way to try and hit home runs. But, you know, they're always thinking 410. I got to hit 410. I got to hit 410. So they should be blasting them out everywhere, because you're never gonna have to deal with longer than that. We've kind of hit all the pertinent points here and throwing a lot of data at you, but I mean, ultimately
there's one other anecdote, and I heard this I heard it from Lesky and Clint, their latest Pintar Press podcast.
Part of RoyalsPodcast.com.
Yep. Where they talked to Jim Callis. Also, you need to go listen to that, because Jim Callis has a lot of interesting stuff about the draft, but that's not part of this. But they were talking about approach, and Lesky and Clint have both been able to go down to spring training a couple of years here. And they were talking about when Seitzer was there, and I guess there was a drill where they would set up a net in front of the cage with the idea that as they're taking their batting practice, they want to hit it underneath the net. So they're trying to hit it at a making a concerted effort to not hit it up into that net. So I guess the idea is they want them to try to, you know, keep a level swing path. But I think one of the side effects of that is if you've got a guy who can hit that home run and you're training him to bring that path of the ball down, maybe that's a problem. So that's an interesting thing.
Yeah, and on top of that, we kind of talk about this in our little email chain that we have on what's about a daily basis here. But some things we talk about and we make it into the show, some things don't. But since you brought that up, something I thought was kind of interesting that we talked about. There's been a lot of – I heard Kevin Seitzer on the radio on my way home today, and because Toronto had the day off because they're – travel day because they're playing, since this is Monday the 28th, the next day they'll be, the Blue Jays will be playing the Royals, and that's where Seitzer's coaching now. Well, he's on with Keatsman, and the part of what he talked about after Seitzer got off the line was, you know, he was ready to get him in, all the texts, all the phone calls about why isn't Seitzer our coach anymore. And I think what's interesting, which we all kind of came to the conclusion on, was that Kevin Seitzer is a really good hitting coach at what he coaches, whereas his fault that I think the Royals recognize, which I actually will agree with, is that he had a more or less one-size-fits-all approach and tried to get all the Royals to try to kind of adhere to that approach. And I've said it before on this show, and I'll always stick to it, that there's no such thing one size fits all. You know, whether it's pitching, whether it's hitting, whether it's fielding, whatever, people are different, bodies are different, they have different abilities, they have different skill sets. You should never have a one size fits all approach. Now, that said, he's incredibly good at teaching that approach. So I think when you saw some success when he was here from different players, Gordon in 2011, Butler in 2012, Hosmer in 2011, you know, they were truly, truly buying into that approach. And then once things got off, you know, maybe they wanted to try something else and try to do things a little differently, and things weren't really working. And then, you know, I don't know what happened to end up leading to his dismissal after the 2012 season. But, you know, I thought we had kind of an interesting discussion on that. And I thought that was kind of interesting. I mean, when you hear an anecdote like that and then what we've kind of talked about, what are your thoughts on that whole scenario?
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear with Seitzer that they were looking at that as an organizational philosophy of, you know, let's hit it this way. And when I think it was when Seitzer was talking to, you know, when he made the rounds after he had been let go by the Royals, you know, the idea was that Ned Yost was saying, okay, this guy can be a 30 home run guy, he can be a 25 home run guy, et cetera, et cetera. And Seitzer thought, no, he can't. And that was kind of the disconnect. And there was this clear kind of dispute between what both sides thought was possible from those guys. And, you know, Seitzer's been right about that. But at the same time, I do have to wonder if, you know, some of those guys might have been able to do that if they hadn't been taught different things while Seitzer was around. And, you know, maybe they would have, and maybe they wouldn't have. Maybe it would have been exactly the same. I mean, it's one of those questions you can never answer because you can't go back and, you know, test it that way. But it is pretty interesting. So I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do about it, but I don't know if anybody in this crop of hitters is going to be able to break Balboni's record, stadium or not. So just I guess we keep waiting.
Yep, and I'm sure we'll keep waiting. So, with that, I think we're about tapped out for the night or the evening or early morning or afternoon or whenever you're listening to the magic of podcasting.
Oh, I do have one more nugget.
Here we go.
This is the most interesting thing that I found in all of this research. The most interesting thing.
Lay it on us.
So we're talking about home runs and hitting home runs. I looked at different eras, the period from 73 to 85, you know, as Balboni was setting the record, the period after Balboni set it, you know, that point after Balboni, but before the fences were moved in, the period where the fences were moved in, the entire, you know, spread from 73 to 94, where the fences were at their original dimensions. Dayton Moore's era, when they moved the fences back, et cetera, all these different periods. And in every single one of those periods, every single period and all time at Kauffman Stadium, the Royals have a better slugging percentage at home than on the road, despite the home runs.
Interesting.
Really counterintuitive, because you would just assume that the home runs are going to result in more, but they don't.
but also one of the Kauffman Park being big and possibly suppressing home runs. What does that also lead to, though, which is what we kind of think the Royals have been targeting, which is your doubles and your triples hitters. And those obviously aren't worth, in terms of a slugging percentage, they're not worth as much as a home run, but they're definitely worth more than a single. So, and was it from 2009 to 2011, Billy Butler hit 50 doubles each year?
Yeah.
So, I mean, those, you're going to start racking up that slugging percentage when you've got players that can hit like that. And they've had a lot of those guys. So, you know, I mean, there is something to be said for playing to your park. And this is something that we'll have to get into later, because one of the things that aggravates me about baseball is the fact that we've spent nearly an hour talking about this point because
that Kauffman Stadium is a different park than anywhere.
Different ballparks.
Yeah.
It's like if you went to Columbia and played Mizzou and the 3-point line is 25 feet, and then you go to KU and you play Lawrence, or you go to Lawrence and you play KU, and the 3-point line is 30 feet, to kind of put it into context of how strange it really is. You know, I mean, there's certain parameters that baseball mandates that you have to have for certain distances and certain points, but you can go further than that. And a lot of teams do. And there are also a lot of scenarios like a Fenway or a Wrigley where the stadiums are old enough that they're grandfathered in. So baseball is not going to go out and say, well, you have to extend right field. You know, you have to extend left field because they're not, these stadiums are so historic, they're not going to do that. But I mean, we won't get into that now because I could go for a long time on that. But that, and I feel like I'm pretty alone in this. I think there's a lot of people that disagree with me, but I just do not at all like the fact that each stadium, I like the uniqueness of like the fountains and the different things like that, but in no way do I like the fact that they're different distances and that a home run hit in one ballpark would not be a home run in all of them.
Yeah. I mean, it's really unique to baseball. It's so strange. And I don't know why. I think it's just one of those things that baseball was first around and that's just kind of what they did and just always been that way.
Yeah. And that sounds about, that's a good enough reason to keep doing it as far as baseball is concerned. They don't like to change too often. No. But that, we'll have to revisit that at a later show because I think we can get some good discussion on that. But with that note, I think we're going to leave you. I don't think we have any more nuggets now. I think now we're all tapped out.
I am nuggetless.
We do not have any more informational nuggets to provide to you. So we will be back with you for next week. And we'll, this is kind of something that I think we're going to start doing, how we're going to have a one topic per show. We're obviously going to talk about any relevant news that happens recently with the Royals, but I think we're going to have kind of one maybe Royals centric topic, and we're going to go a little bit more in depth and try and give you a little bit. Whereas previously we would do this every once in a while. Like we had the pitching episode with Alan Yeager when he came on and we really went in depth with that. But in the past we've kind of broken it up a little bit more. So we're going to try something new a little bit and have these come in your way where we'll try and do something per episode here with a little bit of a Royal slant and go really in depth. So let us know if you like it. Did you like all the information that we gave you here with the home runs, the plate appearances and all that? It was kind of a lot to digest. Hopefully we didn't nerd out too much and we made some sense for you, and you can, you know, everything provided a little bit clearer picture of what we were talking about last week. So, you know, let us write us in kcbaseballvault@gmail.com. Let us know, did you like it? Do you think we should maybe break it up a little bit more? Let us know what you think. And if you have any topics that you'd maybe like us to delve into with this at this kind of a level, then throw them out there. And if it's one that we think will play, then we'll dig into it and we'll give you credit and we'll show it on, we'll talk about it on air. So with that, for Michael Engel and the New Mexico version of Troy Olsen, of course, the soon-to-be Isotope Man.
ABQ Isotope Man.
ABQ Isotope Man. I am Jeff Herr, and we will see you next week. And as always, go Royals.
You have been listening to a Royals Podcast Network presentation.
I am I am your host, Jeff Herr, and this is, with me as always, is Michael Engel for the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you, but you know what? Screw that. We're gonna start over again. I totally forgot the Kelly's thing, and I'm like, I was basically gonna start over anyway, so we'll just do it again.
All right.
I'm new at this. I guess there are a couple places. A couple places in the league. God, sorry.
It's all right.
Jackie's taken up.
Everyone all right?
Yeah, they get protective of their little toys, but
I gotcha.
So
don't we all
interruption there? That's gonna make any outtakes, isn't it? All right.
I'll probably just leave that in.
Okay. Well, yeah, that was my dogs on the show. So.